You're listening to From Marx to Christ, The Memoirs of a Socialist by Dr. David Wood. Dr. Wood is the Senior Associate Pastor of Coquitlam Alliance Church. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 8, 2014 at Willingdon Church.
Okay, well, why don't we get started? Because we only have 45 minutes to cover lots of stuff, right? So, welcome. My name's David Wood. I'm a pastor at Coquitlam Alliance Church. My position's called Senior Associate Pastor, and so I teach spiritual formation, a lot of the discipleship classes, a lot of the teaching at Coquitlam Alliance Church. I've been pastoring in Coquitlam for about 14 years. So, originally from Ontario, but don't hold that against me because I've lived out here long enough. But why don't we begin with prayer, because we there's a lot of things we're going to look at today. So let's pray. Lord Jesus, you're not a philosophy, you're not an idea, you're not a worldview, but you are personal and you are present. You're alive. And so we come before you this afternoon, and we pray that you give us ears to hear, eyes to see, and a heart to receive, and the courage to respond to what you say. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Maybe close it.
Yeah. What does the T stand for? That's my only question.
Todd.
Thank you.
Yeah, a buddy of mine used to remind me that Todd means dead in German. I really appreciated that, yeah.
So you're Deadwood.
I'm Deadwood. Oh, very good. But I'm a beloved Deadwood, because that's what David means. So that helps a little bit. Okay, so what we're going to do today, it's going to be very simple, I hope, in terms of the agenda. Basically, I'd like to look at a couple points. One is ideas have consequences, and that's one of the themes of this whole conference, the Apologetics Conference, is thinking does matter. How you think does shape how you live. And so one of the things that we're going to look at is just, it's going to be somewhat autobiographical. I'm going to be sharing a little bit about how ideas that I held shaped how I lived, and just reflect on the consequence of how we think. Okay. Now, my main point again is ideas have consequences, and I want to give two examples. And it's interesting, our speaker this morning, because here's the two examples. One of them is. What our speaker this morning was sharing on was what happened in 1975 to 1978 in Cambodia with the killing fields and the way that played out under the leadership of Pol Pot and Khieu Samphan. Both were educated in France. Pol Pot was not a very good student. He was anxious to get back. Khieu Samphan was more of the intellectual. But both of them were largely influenced by Marxism, French Marxism, in the mid-20th century. They were influenced by that, and that shaped many of their ideas when they came to power in 1975. The other example I give you is just a recent example. I work a lot with, I encounter a lot of young adults in my day. And one of the influences of postmodern thinking, I mean, postmodern's talked about quite a bit, but it's basically the belief that absolute truth does not exist. I mean, that's one of the tenets of it, one of the ideas behind it. And I remember sitting down with this one student at Douglas College in Coquitlam, and I sat down with him, and we were talking about morality, whether or not absolute morality, whether or not something is good, can something be good outside of yourself, or is simply relative to yourself? Is it simply because I think it's good, or is there a sense of goodness that exists outside of myself? Anyhow, I was talking with this guy, he's a Japanese student who is attending Douglas College, And I asked him, I said, does goodness exist? He says, no, it doesn't. I have views about what's good, but I would not say that this idea of absolute goodness or right or wrong exists outside of myself. I said, okay, well, let me just cut to the chase. I said, honestly, if I took a baby and put the baby on this table and I took a knife and I killed this baby in front of you, would that not, could you not admit that act was at least wrong, morally wrong? And I remember he looked at me and he says, I cannot say that would be morally wrong. He says, the most I could say is that it's wrong to me and that I don't think it'd be a good thing to do. But I could not impose that value upon another person. And I realized at that point, and that was a real watershed moment in my own life, where I just recognized that, you know, ideas really do have consequences. And one of the, just as an aside, one of the consequences, I think, that comes out of postmodernity is the inability to think. I think if you run it down to the end, you run the risk of the inability to think about anything. But let me just back up a little bit. For my own journey, is when I was in high school, I embraced atheism. I had a bad experience at church. We seldom went to church growing up. The one time I did go to church in high school, I remember I got dragged to church by two buddies of mine because I stayed over at night at their place. And so I went to church in the morning, and they happened to be greeting. And so I'm standing up there. I had never been to this church, and it was all awkward. And my two friends were there, and people were walking in. They're going, hello, Roger. Hello, Wayne. And when they came to me, they said, who are you? And I'm like, man, I'm out of here. I'm not coming to church again. Because I just felt so unwelcomed. And that was one of the few experiences I had at church. But it wasn't long after that where... at least in high school, I embraced atheism. I thought this whole idea of God was ridiculous. This carried on in university. When I went to York University in Toronto, and it was during the 80s, and my major was political philosophy and international relations. In the area of political philosophy, at York University, is pretty much mandatory. You had to embrace Marxism. It was just the way of the university at the time. In the area of international relations, though, my area of focus was American foreign policy, in particular, the American foreign policy and its effect on Cambodia, Vietnam, and China. So by the time I ended up into the master's program at York University, my main focus was on the relationships between Cambodia, Vietnam, and China, in particular the effects of refugees along the Thai-Cambodian border after Vietnam invaded in 1978. So, I embraced Marxism at the day. Now, why? Well, there's lots of things you have to recognize about Marxism, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of background, because some of you, you know, in the 80s, everything was... all we talked about was Marxism. Today, a lot of people have no idea what Marxism is all about or what communism is all about. So let me just give you a little bit of background. The people behind Marxism, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels. And it's a 19th century philosophy which emerged out of a recognition that there's a lot of horrors, a lot of horrific things that went part and parcel with the industrialization, especially in Europe, especially in England, too. Marx and Engels, they were horrified by the working conditions in factories and saw capitalism as the source of these problems. In 1848, they published the Communist Manifesto, in which the authors argue for a form of complete socialism in which there would be public ownership of all land and the means of production. And this would ultimately lead to a system called communism. As I say, this is just a brief overview. It is a lot more complex than this. One of the appeals of Marxism, though, at least for me, is that it gave a sense of history, a meaning to history. Marx claimed that the course of history was economically determined. So the history is not just random, but there's actually a meaning and a process to history. And that this was economically determined, with the manner by which goods were produced being the determining force for the structure and the nature of society. So economics, the economics in society shape all aspects of how people relate to one another. Okay, so that's the big idea. Those who controlled the means of production controlled the wealth and controlled power within a society. And so the history of the world, according to Marx, drawing from Hegel, is characterized by a struggle between classes, economic classes, culminating in a great class struggle between the working class, called the, what were they called?
The
proletariat, yeah. And the business class, which would be called the bourgeoisie, right? Yeah. And the struggle would increase until the proletariat would ultimately rise up and take control of the means of production, the factories and whatnot. Once this revolution was won, the proletariat would destroy the capitalists, get rid of the ruling class in society. There would be a temporary dictatorship of the proletariat, so some leaders would say, hey, we're going to help this. We're going to help make the final transition. Interestingly enough, that transition never took place, but the dictatorship remained in place. But they would guide society towards a classless society in which the workers would control the means of production. Workers would control the wealth. And so from each according to his ability to each according to his needs would be the value that would characterize this new society. Now, again, this one of the appeals to Marxism is that it gives a context or a paradigm for understanding history. Saying history is not just random, but there's actually something going on. There's something bigger going on. And that was certainly an appeal to me. It was an interpretive grid to make sense of the world. I was a young guy in university. It critiqued it, you know, it stuck it to the man, right? And, you know, these rotten capitalists owning the means of production, exploiting us poor student workers, you know, whatever, you know. It offered a pretty good critique of the establishment, of the way things were. It was a catalyst for social action. You know, I was quite involved as a Marxist at York University in terms of, you know, demonstrating. I mean, a lot of it was just kind of a social event. Hey, let's go demonstrate. It's fun. It gave some voice to, as a student, you don't have a whole lot of voice. You don't have a whole lot of power. It was an interpretive grid, again, to make sense of the world. And so when I studied international relations and political philosophy, especially when I was studying U.S. foreign policy, I mean, there was no better interpretive grid to study U.S. foreign policy at the time than a Marxist revisionist understanding of the world. And so I would look at the Vietnam War and why the U.S. went into Vietnam, and it wasn't ideology, it was economic interest. It was a way that the U.S. can secure, you know, raw materials that would support this, you know, this prevailing way of doing economics. So it really helped me in terms of doing my schooling, in terms of understanding foreign policy, understanding everything through this Marxist paradigm. Okay? The other thing is, if you learn the Marxist paradigm well, you can do really well in school. And so every essay that I wrote, it basically used this idea of class struggle and this economic struggle as being really foundational for the problems that we see in the world. And I use that to basically critique everything. And so once you got that pattern down as a student, man, you got A's in everything. Right? I would crank out a paper in an evening because, you just get the structure down, you're good to go. But I remember, though, there was an awkward moment. I was in the master's program at York University, and we're all sitting around the table, and we're all talking about Marxism, and we're all talking about the evils of capitalism and the evils of the establishment. And one of my classmates was from Africa, and he asked a question, and he says, "So, professor, when do you think the working class will finally rise up and overthrow the capitalists in Canada?" And it just was this awkward silence. And I remember thinking this, wait a minute. Because everybody kind of looked down and looked down at their feet. Because we realized at that moment, nobody really believed that there was going to be a revolution in Canada. And it was one of those moments that everybody kind of realized that. And they realized that this looks really good in paper, but in terms of the eschatology of Marxism, it's not really going to be playing out. And I'll never forget that, because it kind of put a sense in my mind. It's like, well, wait a minute. What's going on here? Now, what I'd like to do is just share a little bit about one more appeal of Marxism, because all of... And there's different kinds of Marxism, but and especially structuralist Marxism would say that there's very little room for free will, right? Because, you know, you're simply a product of the economic substructure of society. So the way you act, the way you behave, the way you treat other people is really determined by economic factors, primarily. Yeah, there's ideology, there's other things, but it's primarily economic substructures. And one of the consequences of that is that there's not a lot of human agency. There's not a lot of place for the will. Again, there's different kinds of Marxism, but in the kind that that was prevalent at the time. There we go. Now, okay, so how does this play out? In my own life, as I was a Marxist, recognizing that human agency, free will, really doesn't matter a whole lot. One of the consequences of this thinking is that I embraced the freedom to do whatever I wanted. And so it did have moral effects in terms of how I lived my life in university. So in university, I did well in school, but I was a heavy drinker, heavy smoker, experimented quite a bit with drugs, and that was just the way of doing life, right? And it wasn't really an issue. Marxism really didn't have say anything about that. So how I lived my life and how I made choices, Marxism had very little intersection with that. So there's freedom to do basically what I wanted to do. Okay. Now, here's one of the issues, though. When I was at university, there was very little alternative to thinking. The Christians that I did encounter at a university really didn't have a whole lot to say to me. David Bevington has written he's written a book a lot. He's written a number of books on evangelicalism, but he defines evangelicalism by these four aspects. He says evangelicals, they're crucicentric. They believe in the centrality of the cross. They believe that the news is so good they should share it with other people. They believe people should come to a point of personal relationship with Jesus through conversion. They believe that the Bible has authority. One of the things that both Bevington and another guy, Mark Knoll, historians, have lamented is that within evangelicalism, there's very little room for the life of the mind. Okay. And so that's why I love these conferences of Apologetics Canada, because it's really addressing this deficiency. My experience at university, I experienced a lot of different ideas, but the one area that was completely lacking in terms of rigorous ideas was Christianity. The only alternative to Marxism at the time was objectivism. Does anybody know what that is?
No.
It's Ayn Rand. Do you know who Ayn Rand is? Atlas Shrugged and that. It's just radical capitalism. So you got Marx and you got completely the other side. The only alternative to Marxism, at least within political philosophy at York University in the 80s, was objectivism. Any encounter I had with Christians left me thinking that Christians were among the stupidest people I've ever encountered. Completely had there's no engagement with the mind. The Christians I met were few and far between. I considered it my life mission that when I did encounter a Christian, I would make it my point to ridicule him. And so every day at around 1 o'clock, you can set your watch by this, this one Christian would come out in front of the Student Union building and begin preaching. And I would mock him, I would laugh at him, I would put them down. I would engage in an argument afterwards, and I'd walk away and say, you know, these guys are completely intellectually bankrupt. They don't have a leg to stand on. And so Christianity was never really an option for me, because everything I saw did not seem it seemed intellectually bankrupt. And Mark Knoll, in his book Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, laments that. Now, things have changed especially within evangelicalism in the last 25 years, but certainly during the 80s, there wasn't much. And in my mind, as a Marxist, what was religion anyhow? Religion was, what does Marx call religion? Yeah, the opiate of the masses, right? It's just a drug for the ordinary people to kind of numb themselves to the reality, hard reality of the world. So, now, much of this began to change for me. I say this, but part of this is autobiographical. I ended up having an opportunity at the end of my master's program to go to China. I went to China right after Tiananmen Square. And so there weren't too many foreigners in China at the time. And when I first went to China, I had an opportunity to teach in a place called Anhui Province. And when I was in China, I had many students. My students were all master's students at a medical college. And many of my students told me stories about how their parents were either killed or persecuted during the Cultural Revolution. Cultural Revolution in China took place between 1966 and 1976. And you see some of the effects that Mao had upon the society. We can't go into details about this, but I had a student of mine. She told me the only time her father ever beat her was when she accidentally knocked over a little statue of Mao and broke it. And he took the shards of the broken statue, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, walked about 5 miles into the countryside, dug a hole, and buried it. Because if those broken pieces of Mao were found in the house, they were done. They were done as a family. In fact, if you had an enemy during the Cultural Revolution, if you had an enemy, you'd just hang out outside the public washrooms after somebody went in there. If they used, because there's no toilet paper, if they used a newspaper and it had Mao's picture on it, you know, to wipe themselves or whatever, you could use that to get them put into jail. I mean, it was just, there was civil war in Shanghai. Within the period of the Cultural Revolution, conservative estimates say there's 20 million people were killed. 20 million. I mean, we just say those numbers as if they're numbers. 20 million people were killed. And some of my students, their parents were killed during the Cultural Revolution. Needless to say, this had an impact upon my love for Marxism. I began to see some of the effects of Marxism played out within society, and began to look at the history of the Soviet Union as well at this time. And all this led, in my own life, to turn away from Marxism, but to embrace something that's not far away from it, and that's materialism. It's not an accident in China that you go from Marxism, from being a communist country, to being a rabidly materialist country. They're not as far apart as it seems, because both ideas embrace atheism. They're both atheistic in their source. Both Marxism and consumerism embrace materialism. And here's the other thing. There's a saying, you scratch a cynic, and underneath, what do you find? A disillusioned idealist. And when I was in China, it was kind of like the Wild West of China at the time. 1990 is when China was kind of opening up. The Soviet Union had fallen. And there was money to be made in China. And you had a number of people who embraced communism becoming disillusioned with it, and very quickly embracing quick ways to make money. And there's just, you know, rabid cynicism throughout the country, but also a lot of money to be made. And again, ideas have consequences. For me, it did not matter. When I pushed aside Marxism and I embraced materialism, it was not a big shift for me, because now for me, meaning was going to be found ultimately in the pursuit of wealth, power, and prosperity. So in Chinese, it's 如果你有钱，有权，你就好了, right? If you have money, you have power, you're good to go, right? And so I shifted, I maintained my atheism, but I shifted. And I joined with everybody else in a pursuit of power, wealth, and prosperity. And it culminated by working in Shanghai. And I got hired at this company in Shanghai as a marketing manager. And it was an engineering company, a Hong Kong engineering company. And we made hotels and we made shopping malls. So this is early, early on. This is like, there's no shopping malls. There's no highways in Shanghai. This is Shanghai. There's no highways. I don't know if you've been there, but there's highways in Shanghai. But there's nothing. They're just you know, single lane roads or whatever. Most people went places on bicycle. So I ended up as a marketing manager for a company in Shanghai, which was a fancy way of saying, essentially, for this company, I was in charge of bribery for the company. So if we wanted to make contracts or to sign a contract with different companies to make a shopping mall or to make a hotel or whatever, it was my job to bribe them. And so we would put kickbacks into every contract we would do. It would be my job to take people out to karaoke's at night. I'd tell people I had a black belt in karaoke because every night I would go out to karaoke's and get them drunk, get them women, get them whatever they wanted in order to sign these contracts. On a day-to-day basis, I would have a guy come into my office and he would come in with two garbage bags. And he would come off to my desk and pour out the garbage bags, and it'd just be full of Hong Kong dollars, hundreds of thousands of Hong Kong dollars. Because at that time, renminbi was not, it could not be converted into the foreign market, so we had to do it on the black market. And so my job was to convert all that and to do it all in the black market. It was a very corrupt company. It was a very, very corrupt company. Now, here's the point: what I did and how I lived didn't matter. Because again, ideas have consequences. If the world in which you live in is what you see is what you get, and that's what you find within Marxism, and that's what you find within this form of materialism, if what you see is all there is, then there really is no reason for me to behave in a certain way that is good, or that is true, or that is right. It's simply what I found within Marxism, I simply brought it into myself, and basically if it was good for David Wood, then it was morally good. It was not a big shift for me. And in many ways, my life can be described by what Paul talks about in the book of Romans, Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. Hopefully many of you know this passage. It's kind of paradigmatic to the way I was thinking. Paul talks about three exchanges that take place because you and I, we close the blinds to God's revealed existence and character, and we just focus in on ourselves. Rather than worshiping the Creator, we worship the created. That's what Paul's describing in Romans chapter 1. And I remember that was the state of my life. I didn't believe in God. I believed that myself, I was the highest reality. But one of the things that was fascinating, I have a picture here. I don't know if anybody knows where that picture is. Anybody know? It's a mountain called Taishan in Shandong province. We climbed this mountain, some buddies and I. We climbed to the top. There's actually hotels at the top, at least back then. And we'd stay overnight, and in the morning we'd wait to see what is called the Sea of Clouds. The sun coming up and the clouds, and it's just miraculous. It's this wonderful thing. So we stayed up in the mountain all night. In the morning we saw the sun rise, and there's thousands of people, right? And they're all, Taiyang Lai La, you know, the sun's coming up, you know, here it comes, right? And so they're all like excited to see that. I remember seeing the sun come up and being overwhelmed with a sense of awe, with a sense of wonder, and a sense of thankfulness. But as an atheist, I had no one to thank. And Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton, talks about it. He says, the problem with an atheist is that they see something wonderful and they feel feelings of thankfulness, but they have no one to thank. But that caught my attention. It's like, what's going on here? Why am I feeling this way? Paul also talks about an exchange of truth for a lie. And my philosophy, again, was if it was good to me, therefore it was good. But then I wondered about conscience. Is there something, you know, is there something that's just good and right and true that exists without me? And so that became a problem. Paul talks about in the same passage about an exchange of designed relationships for undesigned ones. And for me, I mean, it didn't express itself in homosexuality, but it did express itself in sex for all the wrong reasons. Because, you know, I was looking for intimacy, looking for connection, and I would look for it in whatever way I could. So on a number of levels, this way of life, this way of thinking, this way of living was beginning to slowly destroy me. G.K. Chesterton writes, yeah, I have it on the PowerPoint there. When men choose not to believe in God, they do not thereafter believe in nothing. They then become capable of believing in anything. And that, you know, I don't know your stories, but that was my story. Someone came along with a new idea. If it made sense, be like, yeah, sure, why not? If it's good for me, then it's good. And this affected my thinking. It affected, we probably don't have time. It caused me to be distracted, intellectual fatigue. One of the other things is that it created in my life a lot of inconsistencies. I was a Marxist, I was a materialist, but I loved karate and I loved Eastern martial arts, which is kind of focused on a lot of transcendent ideas. But I could live with those inconsistencies. Failure to draw a right conclusion. I had intellectual apathy. I really didn't care anymore. Dogmatism. I just hold to what I believe, but I really didn't care. Intellectual pride. I remember one time my dad saying to me, I was talking to my younger brother. My younger brother said something stupid. At least I thought it was. And I basically just shut him down. And I remember my dad saying to me, he says, you know what, Todd, because they call me Todd by my middle name, you're smart, but you're being very arrogant. He talked about pride. Vain imagination. At the time when you're a Marxist or even as a materialist, the way I'd respond to anybody's idea about truth or goodness is I'd mock them. And you look at today, most arguments against Christianity and even Christians, the way they respond to materialists, often our arguments are summed up with a sneer. And how do you refute a sneer? And often my arguments against Christianity was like, well, that's just stupid. Well, that's not an argument. But that was my argument. So I would critique things, but I had nothing to offer. I remember sitting... down in this group of people, and there were some Christian women there, and one Christian woman said, you know what, if I get married, one of the things that has to be in place, he needs to be a Christian. And I said, are you? I said, that's stupid. I said, what if he's a nice guy? Really, he has to be a Christian in order for you to date him? I said, that is so narrow-minded. That's a problem with you Christians. Stupid Christians. I mean, that's... but that was my argument. That all I could do was critique. But if their response was, well, what would you say? What is a good criteria for a relationship? I would have nothing to offer. I could only tear down. Couldn't build anything. The other one is this. And this is one of the dangers. The biggest danger with Marxism, I would say, and with materialism. See, the thing about Marxism is that the universe in which, the world in which Marxism flourishes is a world that makes sense. Okay? Marxism does make sense. The world does make sense. It gives you an interpretive lens for understanding the way things are. But here's the danger. The world that results, that all makes sense, is a world that's this big. Okay? G.K. Chesterton, in his book Orthodoxy, talks about the world of the madman. And he says that the materialist world all makes sense. It all fits together. But it's a world that's so small that leaves no room for wonder, no room for love, for joy. All these things, no room for mystery. It all makes sense. And that was my world. My world made sense. But it was a very small world. And you see this, I mean, not to go into detail, but within Marxism, because of its lack of agency, lack of the role of the individual will, and if all we are products of economic substructures, then individual people do not have inherent dignity and value. That's one of the dangers of Marxism. You love humanity, but it's the people you can't stand. Right? And the danger with that is, in order to get to the next level of whatever economic process you think is in place, in order to do that, if you have to take an entire class and remove them from the city and take them into the countryside and eliminate them, then you do that. And that's what happened in Cambodia. It's a working class. The intelligentsia, well, they were the obstacles. They were the obstacles for this agrarian reform. And so if you wore glasses, if you had educated background, you were eliminated. You eliminate the class, and then the workers will flourish. But it doesn't. It's the only thing that results is horror. And you can go through story after story in the 20th century where this took place. In China, it was a great leap forward. The great leap forward was China was going to go from an agrarian economy to, you know, a full-fledged industrial economy, the great leap forward. But in the process, only one problem happened, and that was 25 million people were killed, were starved. And in China at the time, it's interesting, there was one train that was full of food. And the communists would take pictures of this train and show how much food and how this great leap forward was benefiting China. And it would be in all the newspapers. But it was one train. And they just moved from place to place to place to place while the people in the countryside starved. Now, in all this, for myself, just to kind of conclude here, because I know we only have till 1 o'clock, right? For me, the key issue was a crisis of meaning. And it was a question of what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. If what is good, what is true, what is beautiful is simply subjective, or is it outside of myself? Now again, ideas have consequences. For me, I was living a life where chen and chen, money and power. That's all that mattered. And I had finally started making money, and I finally started getting power in this company. And I felt miserable. And I also felt afraid. Because if communism didn't offer meaning, if this form of materialism doesn't offer meaning, could it be, might it be, that there is no meaning to life? Now, I don't know if you've ever looked at that, being in that place, where you wonder if life does have meaning. It is one of the darkest places to be in. Right at that time, I was offered a job. I was working for this company in Shanghai. I was offered a job to go to Beijing to work as an assistant with an Italian mafioso who owned a hotel in Beijing. And I knew him, I connected with him a little bit, and he says, you know, do you want to work with me? And I was considering doing it. Do you know why? Because I had nowhere else to go. Why not? And it was right at that time, a strange story took place. I was with a buddy of mine, he's from Shanghai, he and I were roommates. And he was reading something from a newspaper, and he's saying, telling me a story about what took place at this bus station in, I think it was in Hangzhou, just outside of Shanghai. There was this bus station, and there was these four thieves. And these four thieves were going around robbing people. And so they had knives, and so they would come up to somebody and say, give me your money. And people were just, and if you've ever been to a bus station in China, there's like 30,000 people at this bus station. It's not it is packed full of people. But these four thieves were going from person to person to person, taking their money. And so one person stood up and said, "Hang on, there's 50,000 of us. There's four thieves." And all of a sudden people are like, "Yeah." And the four thieves are like, "Oh no." Right? And so they run. And so they're chasing them, and I guess a bus driver comes along, and a bus driver invites some people on the bus, and they chase down these four thieves, and they grab them, and they arrest them. Now, it's a funny story, but it hit me so hard, because all of a sudden, it made me realize is, you know what? What they were doing was wrong. And all of a sudden, people realize that. Now, right at that same time, a friend of mine, who is an American, who is a Christian. He was the only Christian that never gave me a reason to hate him. He was a good guy. he was quite sharp. And, he and I were chatting. He says, you may be interested in this book. He gave me a copy of Mere Christianity. Now, some of you, by C.S. Lewis, some of you may have read that. If you've read it, you know where it starts. Lewis's starting point is this idea, does goodness exist outside of ourselves? Which is exactly where I was at. Like, is it not wrong when you get on a bus and an old lady's about to sit down, you kick her down and push her out the bus and take her seat? Is that not just wrong? Wrong. Not just wrong to you. Is that not just wrong? And it started me on this journey wondering whether or not what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful, could it exist outside of myself? Now, there's lots more to the story. I mean, the big part of the story is encountering this person named Jesus Christ. And you know the questions, did he exist? Who did he say he was? Did he rise from the dead? And I had to wrestle with those questions. And it was through this process, I was working for the company in a hotel room in Shanghai by myself. I prayed. I said, "God, I'm tired of being God in my own life. I'm tired of trying to somehow instill some kind of meaning into my life because it's not working. I make a lousy God." And so I said, "God, if you're the real deal, if you're the real deal, I give my life to you." And then I didn't know what to do. I'd never read the Bible. I knew two books in the Bible, Genesis and John, only because my brother's name is John, and one of my favorite rock groups at the time was Genesis. That's the only reason I knew those two. So I knew nothing. And I remember I left the company. I went down to Vietnam. That's where my friend was living, this American friend. And I just came to him. I said, "Man, you started this. This Mere Christianity stuff." I said, "Teach me." And he mentored me for a month. And I followed him to Omaha, Nebraska. He mentored me again. But here's the thing. One of the biggest challenges when I became a Christian was not only a change of how I live my life, but more importantly, I would say, it was a change in how I thought and what I thought. And I think a big part of discipleship, and this is the area that I oversee at Coquitlam Alliance, a big part of discipleship is to break the former patterns and ways of thinking, because the way we think has consequences to the way we live. Don't kid yourself if you think there's a connection. Christianity is rooted in a person and an event, and this person and this event makes all the difference. Because one of the things we find within Christianity, again, this is the influence of G.K. Chesterton, is that Marxism would say it's all materialism, and this materialism shapes how we live our life. It shapes the structure of society. Well, Christianity says, every human being, every person has deep value, has deep dignity, and every human being is capable of the most heinous sin. Is it somewhere in the middle? No, it's both. Christianity says, you need to be a slave to Christ in order to be free. You need to die in order to live. And it holds these coexistence extremes. And I think that has a greater resonance with the way things are than any philosophy that I've come across. But But again, when I pray, Jesus, you're not a philosophy, you're not a worldview, you're not an idea, but you are living, you are personal, and you are real, and you reside within me. And one of the biggest dangers of apologetics is very seldom is the Holy Spirit mentioned. But we change, we live, because Christ lives in us. Jesus is the arche and the telos. The Christian life is exploring how Jesus Christ, as the arche, the grand architect, and the telos, the end point of our life, how he intersects with every aspect of our life. Again, it's not a philosophy, not an idea, but Jesus is personal, and truth is relational. So thank you for your time. Look at that, 1 o'clock on the dot.